How can an SLP, a speech language pathologist, help a struggling reader? Do you have or do you work with a student that struggles with phonics, spelling, rhyming, all things reading? Do you have a family history of reading or putting thoughts into words? If you answered yes to any of these, this podcast might be for you. Welcome to the Special Ed Strategist Podcast, where we strategize all things special ed. If you're a new parent to special education or a seasoned parent sitting at the IEP table, come along and join our conversation today. I'm talking with Jeanette Robert, and we're talking through SLP, dyslexia, diversity, and technology. I am your host, Wendy Taylor, a mom and special educator. I have sat on both sides of the IEP table as a parent and a professional. Over the last 25 plus years, I have made it my passion and mission to help parents and professionals bridge learning gaps, access special education services, and build kick-butt IEPs. If you want more tips, show us some love on social at Learning Essentials. If you are new to our podcast, give us a follow. Now let's get ready to strategize special education style. Welcome, welcome. Welcome, welcome, welcome. I am thrilled to chat and have this conversation about dyslexia today and how this can support your world or how it's impacting your world and all of the good stuff. So welcome to the show and thank you for joining us. And I'm glad to have you.
Well, thank you, Wendy, for inviting me. It has been a great opportunity to connect with you and understand what your audience would like to learn about dyslexia. So I'm excited to share.
Absolutely. Can you give us a brief synopsis of who you are and how you got into the world and how this is your passion?
Awesome. So my name is Jeanette Robert, formerly Jeanette Washington. And I have been working as a speech language pathologist for a little over a decade. I learned about dyslexia back in about 2011 because my caseload at the time was full of students who had language-based learning disorders. And I kept hearing the word being thrown out there just casually, like dyslexia. And I was like, what is dyslexia? This was not something that I formally learned in graduate school. So I took it upon myself to start doing more of an analysis of this terminology, where it derived from, what are the symptoms of it? Is this something that's prevalent to my students? Is this something that is well known throughout the district I'm in? And obviously, as you can imagine, I went down a rabbit hole and lo and behold, when I came out on the other side, I decided that I needed to get certified in some different evidence-based practices and really take what I've learned from my independent research and propel that towards some type of educational certification. That is what brought me into the world because, again, I had a very large caseload and my babies were really struggling in the language department. So that was my passion, trying to look at ways in which I could help them to fulfill their potential. Yeah, it brought me here and I've been working in this space for quite some time. Since then, I've earned certifications in the Forward program, the Project READ program, the Letters Early Childhood program, and I've even written a book about dyslexia. So it's brought me a mighty long way.
Well, thank you. And we're going to talk about your book towards the end for sure. Can you just help me elaborate on, so I've had guests talk about dyslexia, but you're coming from a speech pathology lens. So can you help our listeners understand the role of speech pathology as it relates to students with language-based disabilities or specifically dyslexia?
Yeah, so it's funny you ask that because a lot of times within school districts, they don't know who is capable or who is credible when it comes to diagnosing, okay? So educational diagnosticians, neuropsychologists, educational psychologists, developmental pediatricians, behavioral pediatricians, and speech-language pathologists are qualified professionals to assess for dyslexia because of our extensive clinical training that we've received. So when you asked about our role, we have a big role initially as we are getting students, getting learners in the door so that they can start beginning to first get that label, which opens the door to lots of accommodations and support through their academic journey.
Can you then help demystify, is the word I'm trying to say. Let's demystify dyslexia. Can you give us like your different definition from your experience and kind of what does dyslexia truly mean?
Okay. So dyslexia is definitely going to fall under the category of neurotypical because it is a difference neurologically. I always say that this difference impacts your speech, your language, it impacts your writing, and it impacts your reading and spelling. So I always tap on those pillars to let parents know and other professionals know that there are different facets that are impacted and affected by dyslexia. But the International Dyslexia Association often defines it as a specific learning disability that is neurobiological in origin, and it's characterized by difficulties with accurate and fluent word recognition. And so that's how they generally describe it. And the definition can get lengthier if you check out the IDA website. And that's for listeners who want that more in-depth and thorough definition. They can find it there. And it's actually broken down in different ways because it's so lengthy.
Can you give us kind of an example of how can parents apply some of this when they're kind of thinking about their child, their student?
Okay. So I will say first, when we're talking about the breakdown of the definition, it's important to acknowledge that the first definition that the IDA created was in 1994. And in 1994, they got together, a group of professionals, and decided to define dyslexia as an insufficient phonological processing disorder. And it is categorized by single word decoding, which breaks then into reading, writing, and spelling. Now in 2002, they went back to the drawing board because they saw that, yeah, this is a lot more than just those three components that we initially thought. And they added a lot more to it: spelling, accuracy, fluency, comprehension, and vocabulary, and a whole host of other things. So if a parent wants to really understand dyslexia, I think that is a great first step in a diagnosis. If you see something, then say something. If you notice that your child is struggling with attaining nursery rhymes, or if they are struggling with, you know, their verbal working memory. I mean, and you can see these things as early as the age of three. One of the, not symptoms, but characteristics that you'll often see is they have a delay in their speech development. So once you see something as a parent and you bring it to your pediatrician, then those conversations can start to happen. And I would suggest checking out the University of Michigan's Dyslexia Help website, obviously the International Dyslexia Association, and the British Dyslexia Association has some great insight too. It's a lot of, Yale has a Center for Creativity and Dyslexia, and those would be organizations that I would say to kind of tap into and start doing your reading and really begin that process of learning how you are going to be an advocate for your child. And please bear with me, Wendy, if I'm talking too much.
No, I love all this. This is fantastic information. And we're going to link some of these in our show notes so that parents and professionals can have access to these sites that you're referring to, because you're absolutely right. Mm-hmm. It gives it a lot of information and to look over and really kind of figure out to better understand specifically where your child may be or the students that you work with, the children that you work with. And so as you're giving us examples, Jeanette, that's really kind of a broad scope, right? If we're talking about reading, we're talking about phonological awareness, we're talking about spelling, writing. In your experience, do students with dyslexia often showcase all of these, or is it kind of this combination of more so one than another, or a mixed?
That's a great question. So I will say there is a continuum. And so with that continuum, you will see some rather than others, but I will say that for most of the students I've worked with, there has always been that indicator of them not being able to really pick up rhyming words. That to me is always like, yep, we need to do further assessment here. If you are in class and you're doing nursery rhymes and it's just not clicking with those younger students, then we know like, something else may be happening here. But I will say some other indicators that are pretty common are a family history of reading and writing difficulties. When the child reads and then rereads with little comprehension, when a child has difficulty putting thoughts into words, like they have the words, but they just are just struggling as it relates to stringing those words into a sentence. Those are some of the most common indicators that I've seen. And I'm like, wow, yeah, let's do some more activities to see if there is actually something here that needs to be further intervened with.
That's a great point. And that leads me into my next question. So what are some techniques for mitigating barriers to education from kind of your speech and language perspective?
Ooh, so it's kind of layered. I will say for an SLP to suspect dyslexia, they must first expect that that child can be taught to read. We've seen research on implicit biases and lower expectations that a lot of teachers and speech language pathologists and educators all around have when it comes to children of color. I will just say that what's really helpful is for teachers to be aware, for SLPs to be aware. A lot of times we just think, oh, little Johnny, he'll catch up. Oh, Johnny is just being spunky. He doesn't want to do the work, but maybe little Johnny is unable to do the work because he needs some support in getting that work accomplished. So I think when we really look at how dyslexia can be addressed, we need to make sure that the professionals working with these students have done identity work. They have dug deep and understood their privileges, their barriers that they may potentially have, and just understanding how their thought process could implicate or not implicate a student for a disability.
I love how you word it that way. And so if a professional is listening and starting to think, well, maybe I need to kind of dig a little deeper and do some identity work. And I know this really isn't totally about our conversation today, but it is extremely valuable. Where could they look? What could a person do to kind of start that process of becoming more aware? Because that's a really critical point that you have mentioned.
Yeah. So I would say, once you are ready to really dig deep and understand how stereotypes and biases that you hold may be affecting how you're teaching, how you're learning, then the first thing you want to do is, there's so many ways I want to go with this, because the first thing I want to say is tap into your circle. But if everybody in your circle looks like you, or if everybody in your circle has similar experiences, then that just won't do. So I would say there are a couple different organizations that I've worked with, especially when it comes to getting resources for diversity, equity, and inclusion. I would say to look into the Educational Collaborative First, that is a really great program that is offering diversity, equity, inclusion, and justice services. Oh, man, it's so many. And I will say that I've learned of a lot more since the pandemic, because we start to see people saying, like, you know what, I need to work on myself. I have all of this time on my hands. I need to really sit down and figure some things out. So yeah. I would say check out, and this might go over a lot of people's heads, but go on Instagram and look into the search area and just put in DEI or DEIJ. And I think you'd be really surprised at how many accounts come up with people who are doing this work on a regular basis, and just start making it be known that this is the work you want to do and you want to connect with different organizations to make that happen.
I appreciate that little break in our road of conversation for sure. Yeah. To give out some information and really kind of help improve the lives of the folks and the kids that we support. Mm-hmm. And I know I just totally put you on the spot for that. So thank you.
No, it's okay. Cause I was just thinking, like, what would I do if I wanted to do more identity work? And so it was a great question, cause it made me start to really think about what I've done, what I want to do. And I'm thinking, like, for the most part, the most information I've consumed has really been on social media. And so once you click a button and then click another button, and lo and behold, you done found some resources that you could use or some people that you can connect with, and building that community. Again, not being so caught on the people who look like you, talk like you, have the same experiences, but really stepping outside of your comfort zone.
Absolutely, absolutely. Because the students that we serve come mm-hmm. from all different
all walks of life,
backgrounds, everything. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's incredibly important for us as adults and professionals to reflect upon as we're serving our students and serving our personal children.
Yeah.
To kind of wind back to our initial conversation, can behaviors mm-hmm. alone tell us if a student has dyslexia?
I will say that behaviors can certainly be that breadcrumb trail for you as you are going through this journey and navigating these experiences, because what we'll often see is children who are unable to read fluently, they haven't learned to read fluently yet. Those will be the kids that when they get called on, they could potentially, you know, have a temper tantrum. They can have anxiety, which is a comorbidity that we see with dyslexia. And, you know, sometimes when people have anxiety attacks, it's very overwhelming, and they start crying, or they get really stuck in a position or in an emotion, and we're unable to coax them out of it. So I would say behavior could certainly be something that you should watch out for, because it's telling you something. It is a form of communication. So we want to make sure we are very aware of the behaviors. I mean, I've seen kids, like, you know, start fighting another child just to get the attention off of them reading. Like, they'll push somebody. Or, you know, you have the class clown who may want to do something really silly and get the class off track and distracted because they don't want to write. Or, you know, it's so many different behaviors that can help lead you to a better understanding.
I think that goes for a lot of different challenges that a kid mm-hmm. may have, right? That behavior tells mm-hmm. us so much of what's going on, and really kind of thinking through of what is the root cause, you know, that antecedent of causing that behavior, and then kind of working from there to really discern what's happening. As a speech language pathologist, are there specific tests that we had talked about in the very beginning about testing and evaluating students? Are there specific tests that parents can request or evaluators can use that can help identify dyslexia in a student?
Great question again. I will say that this is actually a long form question, so just rock with me. So first and foremost, if you suspect that a child may have some language-based learning disorders, then the first thing you want to do is use a screener. Okay, a screener is going to be that snapshot of the child's development, and it is going to help indicate whether further evaluation is needed. So once you do that screener, and there are some really good screeners out there, I have an evidence-based screener that is online. Also PAR, which is Predictive Assessment of Reading. That's a great one. Shaywitz Dyslexia Screener is also a great one. And then Texas Primary Reading Inventory. So once you get that screener in place, and you see like, okay, it might be a little something happening here. Then what I would do is not only get the family history, but you want to get the intervention history. Has the teacher intervened in any way to help support this child? Has this child seen a speech language pathologist before? And if so, how long? What did they work on? What were the goals that they set out to accomplish? After getting that, obviously you want to have that academic history as well. So then you will have that complete evaluation. After you get those things, then that will be what helps prompt you into doing actual standardized assessments. Now, I can tell you a list of those and kind of what they assess, but I think it's important to first do that screener to check the benchmarks, check the milestones, and really see where that child is. And if you think that further testing should be warranted, then that's when you go and grab all of that other data. A lot of times people do grab the data first and then they do the screener, or which I think is probably the smartest way, is to do all of those simultaneously just so you can have them. So you're getting the intervention info, you're getting the family history, and you're also working to screen that child just so you'll have all of those eggs in the basket. So when it comes to assessment, you want to do oral language, you want to do vocabulary knowledge, phonological processing, spelling and writing, rapid automatic naming, reading comprehension, reading fluency. Also want to make sure you do decoding. So you're going to be assessing all of those different areas. Now, there are tons of tests like the CEL-5 and the PPVT and the GORT and the WISC-V. It can get a little lengthy, I don't want to say time consuming once you start assessing all of those things. But again, I think doing the screener is going to help you weed out whether there needs to be further assessment, because you might do the screener and say, okay, this child is, well beyond their peers, or maybe we can support this child in this way. And then we'll come back to the drawing board to see if they need more support with something else, or if we can accommodate them in another way. So sometimes those screeners can let us know if we really need to do all the extra work, or if we can just hone in on a certain skill set.
And having that kind of really then answers a question before about the continuum in terms of where students are impacted. That knowledge is power, so that we can then better program for our students. We know we can better look at some research-based interventions and accommodations. Mm-hmm. So it gives us that information as professionals to support that student. And let me ask you, Jeanette, so you've mentioned language-based disorders and we've talked about dyslexia. How are the two, are they the same? Are they similar? Are they not? Just as a parent listening, how can they discern the difference?
So I would say they're very similar. We also have different learning disorders that are happening around the language space, like developmental language disorders. That's also one that has been often mistaken for dyslexia. They have very nuanced characteristics, but I would say that for parents that are listening, it's just important to understand where the struggle is. You know, is the struggle comprehension? Are they able to read the passage, but they just can't understand what that passage is entailing? You know, just understanding those very specific details in your child's struggle is going to be what makes the difference.
Let's talk about the co-occurrence again. What can mm-hmm. that look like? Because we talked about the co-occurrence with other neurodiversities, and then how does that play out for a student?
So we did talk about anxiety and dyslexia very briefly. Those co-occur frequently. There is also the co-occurrence of ADHD and dyslexia. And from what statistics show, it's a little over 40% of those that have been diagnosed with dyslexia also have an ADHD diagnosis. So I've even seen research on dyslexia and autism, but the prevalence was not very high. So I think in the world we live in, we definitely have to be prepared for the different occurrences and how they will show up. So for instance, my son is intellectually gifted, but he also has an anxiety disorder. So he is what they call twice exceptional. So I just think that is the age of, you know, of the time we're in. Nobody is just going to just have the one thing that they're struggling with. Everybody is doubling up, for lack of better words. So, I mean, that's just from what I've been seeing. And I don't even know. It'll be great to see how research plays out after the pandemic, if that has been what has caused so much anxiety amongst children, or just so much uneasiness, or so much ADHD, because we're seeing, and let me just take this back real quick, but what we're seeing, I think, as parents, that, you know, when we drop our kids off and they just like are out of our care, out of our hair, I think the pandemic helped us see like, ooh, these kids are, they're a handful.
So now you feel a lot behind the curtain.
Yeah, it's a lot happening. So maybe that teacher isn't telling you that little Johnny was swinging from the rafters because she was able to handle it and maintain it and get them down. But you're able to see now that you've spent some time with them doing the homeschool, like Johnny is, he got a lot of energy.
So as a parent, you're starting to see this stuff, right? You're saying, oh, little Johnny, whew, all right. what could the parent do, or what should the parent do to address the school with their concerns?
Good question. So I often think that the parents should talk to the pediatricians first. That's what I often think in my mind. And maybe that's because I work in, you know, that space as an SLP, where you're working between the medical setting and then between the educational setting. I would say talking to the pediatrician first would be helpful, because you have one professional on board now. You know, you have that ally already. And then when you approach the school, you can say, this is what the pediatrician and I have noticed. These are some things that we would potentially like assessed. I just feel like when you come with that type of receipt, so to speak, then educators take it a little bit more seriously. The district tends to look at it more intently when you have another professional who is almost like co-signed. But if you don't go directly to the pediatrician and you go to the teacher, you can start with just a letter, because that letter gets the ball rolling. This is what I've noticed with little Johnny. I'm not sure if this is something you've noticed, but I'd like to get him assessed. I'd like to have them assessed and go from there. And you can be more specific about what you'd like them assessed for. Sometimes as parents, who don't know like the terminology or the jargon that the educators use, you can just make it very specific. I would like to see whether he has a reading disability. I would like to see if there is a language issue or complication happening, you know, things of that nature.
How does the law, our law, IDEA, apply to that letter? And that is a great nugget to share with families in terms of put it in writing and be as specific as you can in that letter.
So IDEA is very beneficial when it comes to children with potential disabilities. For those who are listening, that is the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. And it's a law that makes available appropriate public education to eligible children with disabilities throughout the nation and ensures special education and related services to those children. So IDEA is extremely essential, especially when it comes to those with dyslexia. But what we're often seeing is that individuals with dyslexia fall into that category of getting a 504 plan. And so the 504 plan is going to ensure that that child has accommodations. It is the Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act, which began in 1973. And it's frequently applied in cases where students may not be provided with an IEP, because an IEP is sometimes, well, I won't say sometimes, I would say frequently, children who are diagnosed with dyslexia do not fall under that individualized education program. They tend to fall into the 504, which specifies that those children get accommodations. Accommodations could be something simple as the child is able to get their lesson written down by the teacher or typed by the teacher, and she orally presents it to them, that they can use audiobooks in classes, or that they can record the lecture for the day so they can come back and listen to it and spend more time trying to comprehend what is due.
So if a child qualifies for a 504, that will give them the accommodations, or if they qualify for an IEP, where does that IEP team fit in for a student with dyslexia? Like writing goals for these students, what could that look like for a student identified as having a language-based disorder?
So I've seen goals that are a lot different from what I'm used to. I think goals now are neurodiversity affirming. So what that means is that the goals like to highlight the strengths of the child and continue to establish baselines based on what they're really good at. I think when I was working back in the public school sector, a lot of the goals that I saw would be, you know, that this child can do X, Y, and Z three times, and that will be their indicate of mastery. But now things are looking a lot different. I haven't seen any IEPs for individuals with dyslexia, so I haven't seen any goals, but language-based goals could look like, you know, the child is able to produce a preposition in a sentence correctly, or the child will be able to write their proper nouns effortlessly in a paragraph, just things like that, that showcase that that child is making progress.
What could a parent ask for at an IEP table that maybe they wouldn't know that they could ask for that would really be a game changer for that student?
So that is going to be subjective, but what I would say is what I've found with almost nearly all of my dyslexic students is that they enjoy audibles. They enjoy being able to listen rather than read because they are spending less time and less effort trying to decode and encode different words, and listening helps them comprehend seamlessly. I also have seen graphic organizers being used effectively. And I think that individuals with dyslexia need more time with assessments, primarily because they are taking a little longer to process that text.
And from that SLP lens, how would you contribute to that IEP? So if a parent came in and they see an SLP, speech and language pathologist, as part of their IEP team, kind of what would your role look like?
So an SLP would discuss the language goals that are at stake or that are at the table. Like maybe it's a language goal about directions or increasing vocabulary. Those types of things would be what that SLP can bring to the table as far as having dialogue with other professionals and having exchanges with parents about goals, verbal prompts, core vocabulary words, and things like that.
So let's go back for a second. You had mentioned that the medical and the educational model, and so that can become confusing for both parents and professionals in terms of the medical model tends to be different than an educational model. And so in your experience as a speech language pathologist, how does that differ, just to give insight for folks that are listening?
Well, dyslexia is not a medical diagnosis. So I am primarily speaking from the fact that I've worked across different settings, and sometimes I have to take one hat off and put the other hat on. So when it comes to distinguishing the two for parents, I would say it's often helpful for you to get the pediatrician's opinion, because the pediatrician is going to be the one that can refer you out to that behavioral pediatrician. They can refer you out to that educational psychologist that works within their network. They can refer you out to individuals who are working within that medical / educational scope. So that's why it's important to get their opinion as well. But either you get their opinion or you just go straight into your school and work directly with them. Either way is fine. I've just always been of the opinion that, you know, when I am going to my child's school, I want to have some backup. So I want to have that letter or that note from that other person I talked to before I came to tell them that there was an issue. And it's all about the paper trail, you know, essentially.
Amen. It truly is, isn't it? Yes.
You know, the sooner you start the paper trail and understanding and acknowledging it, the better you'll be when it comes to advocating for your child or organizing meetings or even getting the paperwork ready when you're sitting down with the SLP, when you're sitting down with the educational diagnostician or the neuropsychologist. You're able to say, hey, this is what was provided to me. This is what this professional has already signed off on.
How do we collect data on dyslexia? So if I'm in a school and I'm either a special educator in a school or a general educator, how could I go about collecting data for this student?
So on my TPT store, I actually have like a checklist, and I would say looking at those key domains, if you have a student with dyslexia. So for instance, knowing whether they have issues with phonological processing, and when you're giving them an activity that involves phonological processing, and you see that they're struggling with that, making note of that, knowing that reading comprehension is a big component of dyslexia. And when you are reading together, what are those experiences like? Making a note of that. So I would say using like a little checklist as you go, that would include that word recognition, decoding, even rhyming would help to understand as you are painting that full picture.
Could a parent use that checklist? Like if a parent wants to come to school with data, mm-hmm. kind of back up their concern, mm-hmm. would that relate, or do you have another treasure.
Yeah, it's the same one. And I think so. I believe that if a parent comes to the school and they show this checklist and say, hey, I found difficulties in each of these areas are usually synonymous with dyslexia characteristics. So I would like to have my child assessed.
What are some ways that you have seen successful partnerships formed between an SLP and the school team, a parent and the school team? Kind of what are some success stories that you have found as seeing better outcomes?
Okay. So I would say when everybody takes away their personal maybe issues with their colleagues, and they focus all of their attention on trying to see this child at their full potential. I think there are a lot of egos when it comes to IEP meetings. People are self-important, and they come to the table and then they want to brag about all the credentials they have or the experience they've put in. But I think at the end of the day, when everybody is willing to put all of that behind so that they can look forward to assisting this student, that's what makes the partnership go smoothly, because now they're looking from the lens of support and not necessarily the lens of, you know, these different characteristics that appear when we get in a room full of other professionals and then, you know, there's a lot of things. I'm gonna just leave it there. There's a lot of things. Some people feel like I can do this. You can't say that. It's a lot sometimes, but I think when we put that behind us and say, okay, let's focus on this child and what we can all do collectively to help them reach their full potential. So maybe just setting the tone at the beginning of the meeting, like, hey, I'm taking my armor off and I'm putting it to the side. Yeah. I am meeting with you all so that we can all be on the same page. This is the same fight we're fighting, not each other.
That's right. That's right. And it's not always easy to do that. I have seen in meetings for people, but I really think if we have that service lean and we lean into that, like we're here to serve this child so that they can be the best version of themselves and create that atmosphere of trust at the table, because I think there's times where either parents or professionals come in, like you said, with that armor and that defensiveness. So to be able to form that relationship prior to coming to the table and setting that tone can really be helpful.
Mm-hmm. And I like what you said about trust. That is very vital. It's very vital. You know, that I can trust you to make sure that the evidence you're providing is substantial, and that we can trust each other to do our due diligence to make sure that this child reaches their full potential. Or as you said, you said something so eloquently. I can't remember how you said it, but it wasn't bringing their full self to the table. It was something.
Right, exactly. We'll have to rewind it. Sorry, we're reminding you. So, but thank you for that. Can you dropped that you have a book. Let's talk about it. Tell me about your book.
Oh, sure. Brag about myself. Why won't I?
No, let's do it.
So in 2019, I wrote a book about how dyslexic individuals can be an asset to the tech sector. And within this book, it's called Technical Difficulties, Why Dyslexic Narratives Matter in Tech. It talks about how dyslexics are very empathetic and how they can use that as well as their natural gifts, like, you know, thinking outside of the box and episodic memory, to really create innovative technology that we've never seen before. So as I stated about, you know, being around people that look like us and have similar experiences, we see that a lot in the corporate tech sector, where all of the employees at a company all look alike. They probably have very similar cars. And, you know, so it's nice when that's disrupted by someone who has a different way of thinking, someone who has that natural neurodivergence, and they come in and they can provide insight in a very empathetic way and a very dynamic way. And so that's what the book is all about. It's a really great book, if I say so myself. And I just really spent time interviewing individuals who worked in tech, who have dyslexia, and talking to them about their experiences. And I just put it out into the world. So I'm happy about it. And I hope that more people are able to benefit from its content. I've had some great reviews. And I think it's only up from here. So I'm hopeful that maybe I'll do a second edition. Who knows?
I love that. Can you give us some low-hanging fruit in terms of how a student could start to create their pathway to that technology field?
Ooh, great question. So I would say, man, that's a really good question. So if that child is interested in tech, I would say that they should narrow down what part of tech they want to be in. Because as you can imagine, everything is really tech focused now. The medical fields are tech focused now. Just anything you can name, even education and just so many sectors around us are tech enabled. So just understanding exactly what it is they are passionate about, what they want to bring to the world, create for the world, and start looking up free courses and classes in that area. Because this is the age of society where everything can be found on your favorite search engine. So there are free classes on different platforms that help kind of hone those skill sets in that you are passionate about. So I would say kind of understanding how they want to change the world. And from there, it's very simple to find courses that are free on all of our favorite course sites and kind of just diving deeper into that work. Because sometimes what they'll find is, man, I thought I was passionate about that, but I'm not quite passionate about that. And that's good too, because it's getting you closer to where your passions lie. So starting early is my low-hanging fruit. Start early. Even if that child is 13 or 12 or whatever, start probing them to see how they want to change the world. And as a parent, you can also use your favorite search engine. They don't have to, as, you know, as frequently. You can look and see what is going on. They have STEM programs everywhere.
I have a smile on my face because I am a mom of three boys. And so when I hear tech, I automatically think of like video gamers and programming in that space. But I love and appreciate that you talk about the medical space and the educational space. So there's a lot of different avenues one could go into.
And farming, agriculture, like goodness.
Yeah. So I think that is just tremendous within itself to have that with your child and to start it with, how are you going to change the world? I'm going to have that conversation tonight at supper with my boys.
They're going to be looking at you like, huh? But you know, that's a good starting question though. It gets the conversation going and, you know, hopefully you'll see those light bulbs pop at the top of their heads. Because that excitement is going to be what drives them towards their passion.
That's right. That's right. As we wrap up, and I love this, and I will link your book and our show notes so that folks can take a read and open up some more ideas and have bigger light bulb moments with that. Mm-hmm. And so I appreciate that for you sharing with us. If you are my final question, if you had one tip for parents to place on a billboard, what would it be and why?
Wow. Man, You got me right there. I would say one tip to place on a billboard would be, don't forget to show your child love. You know, sometimes we get so caught up in dealing with the stressors of assessments, the diagnosis process, you know, the calls from the teacher, the complaints from the school, our own work that we're doing, whether it is external or interior work that we're working through, that we don't get to love on our kids. We don't show them how much we really appreciate them being in this world. And I think that we have to do more of that. You know, show them love, let them know that we are their allies. You know, we're fighting this fight, we're going through these things, we're right here with you, like side by side. And I think that's how children end up having difficulties as adults with childhood trauma, oh my gosh, because, you know, their parent was so busy fighting the fight that they never stopped to just say, hey, I love you and I'm here for you. So that's what I would say.
And that's how we build a better community.
Agreed. Agreed.
Wow. Thank you so much for this tremendous, incredible dialogue and just adding your approach and your practice to the conversation and threading in some really fabulous tips for everybody that's listening. So I really appreciate your time.
You are very welcome.
Thank you. Thank you again for listening to this instrumental discussion, identifying aspects of dyslexia through the lens of a speech language pathologist. Three strategies that I took away from our conversation are: check out resources, follow the breadcrumb trail of behavior, whether it's reading fluency, reading skills, frustration, anxiety, follow that to see what your next step should be, meaning should you get a screening? And then how do you want to change the world? Ask your kids that question. And what field of technology can showcase your child's strength? I think it's an interesting, fascinating tip to dive into. Thank you again for strategizing with us and spending your precious ear time listening. If you've loved what you've heard, give us a like and a follow at Learning Essentials or the Special Ed Strategist podcast. Looking for free tips? Head on over to learningessentialsedu.com. And you can download free tips to prepare for an IEP meeting, plus bonus questions to ask. I am your host, Wendy Taylor. If you need more special education support, visit Learning Essentials, where we provide an individualized and systematic approach to supporting students with various learning needs and differences through academic coaching, educational therapy, and Brain Camp, our executive function support model. If you're a parent, we've got you covered through IEP coaching.